This is Audible.
Harper Children's Audio presents Walk Two Moons by Sharon Creech. Read by Hope Davis. Copyright 1994 by Sharon Creech. Production copyright 2006 by HarperCollins Publishers. Chapter 1. A Face at the Window. Gramp says that I am a country girl at heart, and that is true. I have lived most of my 13 years in Bybanks, Kentucky, which is not much more than a caboodle of houses roosting in a green spot alongside the Ohio River. Just over a year ago, my father plucked me up like a weed and took me and all our belongings. No, that is not true. He did not bring the chestnut tree, the willow, the maple, the hayloft, or the swimming hole, which all belonged to me. And we drove 300 miles straight north and stopped in front of a house in Euclid, Ohio. "No trees?" I said. "This is where we're going to live?"
"No," said my father. "This is Margaret's house."
The front door of the house opened, and a lady with wild red hair stood there. I looked up and down the street. The houses were all jammed together like a row of birdhouses. In front of each house was a tiny square of grass, and in front of that was a thin gray sidewalk running alongside a gray road. "Where's the barn?" I asked. "The river, the swimming hole."
"Oh, Sal," my father said. "Come on, there's Margaret."
He waved to the lady at the door.
"We have to go back. I forgot something."
The lady with the wild red hair opened the door and came out onto the porch.
"In the back of the closet," I said, "under the floorboards. I put something there, and I've got to have it."
"Don't be a goose. Come and see Margaret."
I did not want to see Margaret. I stood there, looking around, and that's when I saw the face pressed up against an upstairs window next door. It was a round girl's face, and it looked afraid. I didn't know it then, but that face belonged to Phoebe Winterbottom, a girl who had a powerful imagination, who would become my friend, and who would have many peculiar things happen to her. Not long ago, when I was locked in a car with my grandparents for 6 days, I told them the story of Phoebe, and when I finished telling them, or maybe even as I was telling them, I realized that the story of Phoebe was like the plaster wall in our old house in Bybanks, Kentucky. My father started chipping away at a plaster wall in the living room of our house in Bybanks shortly after my mother left us one April morning. Our house was an old farmhouse that my parents had been restoring, room by room. Each night, as he waited to hear from my mother, he chipped away at that wall. On the night that we got the bad news that she was not returning, he pounded and pounded on that wall with a chisel and hammer. At 2 o'clock in the morning, he came up to my room. I was not asleep. He led me downstairs and showed me what he had found. Hidden behind the wall was a brick fireplace. The reason that Phoebe's story reminds me of that plaster wall and the hidden fireplace is that beneath Phoebe's story was another one. Mine. Chapter 2. The Chickabiddie Starts a Story. It was after all the adventures of Phoebe that my grandparents came up with a plan to drive from Kentucky to Ohio, where they would pick me up, and then the three of us would drive 2,000 miles west to Lewiston, Idaho. This is how I came to be locked in a car with them for nearly a week. It was not a trip I was eager to take, but it was one I had to take. Gramps had said,
"We'll see the whole ding-dong country."
Graham squeezed my cheeks and said, "This trip will give me a chance to be with my favorite Chickabiddie again." I am, by the way, their only Chickabiddie. My father said that Graham couldn't read maps worth a hill of beans and that he was grateful that I had agreed to go along with them and help them find their way. I was only 13, and although I did have a way with maps, it was not really because of that skill that I was going. nor was it to see the whole ding-dong country that Gram and Gramps were going. The real reasons were buried beneath piles and piles of unsaid things. Some of the real reasons were, 1, Gram and Gramps wanted to see Mama, who was resting peacefully in Lewiston, Idaho. 2, Gram and Gramps knew that I wanted to see Mama, but that I was afraid to. 3, Dad wanted to be alone with the redhead Margaret cadaver. He had already seen Mama, and he had not taken me. Also, although this wasn't as important, Dad did not trust Gram and Gramps to behave themselves along the way unless they had me with them. Dad said that if they tried to go on their own, he would save everyone a lot of time and embarrassment by calling the police and having them arrested before they even left the driveway. It might sound a bit extreme for a man to call the police on his own tottery old parents, but when my grandparents got in a car, trouble just naturally followed them like a filly trailing behind a mare. My grandparents, Hiddle, were my father's parents, full up to the tops of their heads with goodness and sweetness, and mixed in with all that goodness and sweetness was a large dash of peculiarity. This combination made them interesting to know, but you could never predict what they would do or say. Once it was settled that the three of us would go, the journey took on an alarming, expanding need to hurry that was like a walloping great thundercloud assembling around me. During the week before we left, the sound of the wind was, "Hurry, hurry, hurry." And at night, even the silent darkness whispered, "Rush, rush, rush." I did not think we would ever leave, and yet I did not want to leave. I did not really expect to survive the trip. But I had decided to go, and I would go, and I had to be there by my mother's birthday. This was extremely important. I believed that if there was any chance to bring my mother back home, it would happen on her birthday. If I had said this aloud to my father or to my grandparents, they would have said that I might as well try to catch a fish in the air, so I did not say it aloud, but I believed it. Sometimes I am as ornery and stubborn as an old donkey. My father says I lean on broken reeds and will get a face full of swamp mud one day. When at last Gram and Gramps Hiddle and I set out that first day of the trip, I prayed for the first 30 minutes solid. I prayed that we would not be in an accident. I was terrified of cars and buses. And that we would get there by my mother's birthday, 7 days away, and that we would bring her home. Over and over, I prayed the same thing. I prayed to trees. This was easier than praying directly to God. There was nearly always a tree nearby. As we pulled onto the Ohio Turnpike, which is the flattest, straightest piece of road in God's whole creation, Gram interrupted my prayers. "Salamanca." I should explain right off that my real name is Salamanca Tree Hiddle. Salamanca, my parents thought, was the name of the Indian tribe to which my great-great-grandmother belonged. My parents were mistaken. The name of the tribe was Seneca, but since my parents did not discover their error until after I was born and they were by then used to my name, it remained Salamanca. My middle name, Tree, comes from your basic tree, a thing of such beauty to my mother that she made it part of my name. She wanted to be more specific and use Sugar Maple Tree, her very favorite, but Salamanca Sugar Maple Tree Hiddle was a bit much even for her. My mother used to call me Salamanca, but after she left, only my grandparents Hiddle called me Salamanca when they were not calling me Chickabiddy. To most other people, I was Sal, and to a few boys who thought they were especially amusing, I was Salamander. In the car, as we started our long journey to Lewiston, Idaho, my grandmother Hiddle said, "Salamanca, why don't you entertain us?" "What sort of thing did you have in mind?" Gramp said, "How about a story? Spin us a yarn." I certainly do know heaps of stories, but I learned most of them from Gramps. Gram suggested I tell one about my mother. That I could not do. I had just reached the point where I could stop thinking about her every minute of every day. Gramp said, "Well then, what about your friends?"
You got any tales to tell about them?
Instantly, Phoebe Winterbottom came to mind. There was certainly a hog's belly full of things to tell about her.
I could tell you an extensively strange story, I warned. Oh, good, Gram said. Delicious.
And that is how I happened to suspend my tree prayers and tell them about Phoebe Winterbottom, her disappearing mother, and the lunatic. Chapter 3. Bravery. Because I first saw Phoebe on the day my father and I moved to Euclid, I began my story of Phoebe with the visit to the red-headed Margaret cadavers, where I also met Mrs. Partridge, her elderly mother. Margaret nearly fell over herself being nice to me. "What lovely hair," she said, "and aren't you sweet?"
I was not sweet that day. I was being particularly ornery. I wouldn't sit down, and I wouldn't look at Margaret.
As we were leaving, Margaret whispered to my father, "John, have you told her yet how we met?" My father looked uncomfortable.
"No," he said. "I tried, but she doesn't want to know."
Now that was the truth, absolutely. Who cares, I thought. Who cares how he met Margaret Cadaver? When at last we left Mrs. Cadaver and Mrs. Partridge, we drove for approximately 3 minutes. 2 blocks from Margaret Cadaver's was the place where my father and I were now going to live. Tiny, squirt trees. Little birdhouses in a row. And one of those birdhouses was ours. No swimming hole, no barn, no cows, no chickens, no pigs. Instead, a little white house with a miniature patch of green grass in front of it. It wasn't enough grass to keep a cow alive for 5 minutes.
"Let's take a tour,"
my father said, rather too heartily. We walked through the tiny living room into the miniature kitchen and upstairs into my father's pint-sized bedroom and on into my pocket-sized bedroom and into the wee bathroom. I looked out the upstairs window down into the backyard. Half of the tiny yard was a cement patio, and the other half was another patch of grass that our imaginary cow would devour in 2 bites. There was a tall wooden fence all around the yard, and to the left and right of our yard were other identical fenced plots. After the move-in van arrived and 2 men crammed our Bybanks furniture into our birdhouse, my father and I inched into the living room, crawling over sofas and chairs and tables and boxes, boxes, boxes.
My father said. "It looks as if we tried to squeeze all the animals into the chicken coop."
3 days later, I started school and saw Phoebe again. She was in my class. Most of the kids in my new school spoke in quick, sharp bursts and dressed in stiff new clothes and wore braces on their teeth. Most girls wore their hair in exactly the same way, in a shoulder-length bob, that's what they called it, with long bangs that they repeatedly shook out of their eyes. We once had a horse who did that. Everybody kept touching my hair. "Don't you ever cut it?" they said. "Can you sit on it? How do you wash it? Is it naturally black like that? Do you use conditioner?" I couldn't tell if they liked my hair or if they thought I looked like a wang doodle. One girl, Mary Lou Finney, said the most peculiar things. Like out of the blue, she would say, "Omnipotent," or "Beef brain." I couldn't make any sense of it. There were Megan and Christy, who jumped up and down like parched peas, Moody Beth Ann and pink-cheeked Alex. There was Ben, who drew cartoons all day long, and a peculiar English teacher named Mr. Berkway. And then there was Phoebe Winterbottom. Ben called her Freebie Icebottom and drew a picture of a bumblebee with an ice cube on its bottom. Phoebe tore it up. Phoebe was a quiet girl who stayed mostly by herself. She had a pleasant, round face and huge, enormous, sky-blue eyes. Around this pleasant, round face, her hair, as yellow as a crow's foot,
curled in short ringlets. During that first week, when my father and I were at Margaret's, we ate dinner there 3 times that week, I saw Phoebe's face twice more at her window. Once I waved at her, but she didn't seem to notice, and at school she never mentioned that she had seen me. Then, one day at lunch, she slid into the seat next to me and said, "Sal, you're so courageous. You're ever so brave." To tell you the truth, I was surprised. You could have knocked me over with a chicken feather. "Me? I'm not brave," I said. "You are. You are brave." I was not. I, Salamanca Tree Hiddle, was afraid of lots and lots of things. For example, I was terrified of car accidents, death, cancer, brain tumors, nuclear war, pregnant women, loud noises, strict teachers, elevators, and scads of other things. But I was not afraid of spiders, snakes, and wasps. Phoebe, and nearly everyone else in my new class, did not have much fondness for these creatures. But on that day, when a dignified black spider was investigating my desk, I cupped my hands around it, carried it to the open window, and set it on the outside ledge. Mary Lou Finney said, "Alpha and Omega, will you look at that?" Beth Ann was white as milk. All around the room, people were acting as if I had single-handedly taken on a fire-breathing dragon. What I have since realized is that if people expect you to be brave, sometimes you pretend that you are, even when you are frightened down to your very bones. But this was later, during the whole thing with Phoebe's lunatic, that I realized this. At this point in my story, Graham interrupted me to say, "Why, Salamanca, of course you're brave. All the Hiddles are brave. It's a family trait. Look at your daddy, your mama." "Mama's not a real Hiddle," I said. "She practically is," said Graham. "You can't be married to a Hiddle that long and not become a Hiddle." That is not what my mother used to say. She would tell my father, "You Hiddles are a mystery to me. I'll never be a true Hiddle." She did not say this proudly. She said it as if she were sorry about it, as if it were some sort of failing in her. My mother's parents, my other set of grandparents, are Pickfords, and they are as unlike my grandparents' Hiddle as a donkey is unlike a pickle. Grandmother and Grandfather Pickford stand straight up, as if sturdy steel poles ran down their backs. They wear starched, iron clothing, and when they are shocked or surprised, which is often, they say, "Really? Is that so?" And their eyes open wide and their mouths turn down at the corners. Once, I asked my mother why Grandmother and Grandfather Pickford never laughed. My mother said, "They're just so busy being respectable. It takes a lot of concentration to be that respectable." And then my mother laughed and laughed in a gentle way. And you could tell her own spine was not made of steel, because she bent in half, laughing and laughing. My mother said that Grandmother Pickford's one act of defiance in her whole life as a Pickford was in naming her. Grandmother Pickford, whose own name is Gayfeather, named my mother Chanhassen. It's an Indian name meaning tree sweet juice, or in other words, maple sugar. Only Grandmother Pickford ever called my mother by her Indian name, though. Everyone else called my mother Sugar. Most of the time, my mother seemed nothing like her parents at all, and it was hard for me to imagine that she had come from them. But occasionally, in small, unexpected moments, the corners of my mother's mouth would turn down and she'd say, "Really? Is that so?" and sound exactly like a Pickford. Chapter 4. That's What I'm Telling You. On the day that Phoebe sat next to me at lunch and told me I was brave, she invited me to her house for dinner. To be honest, I was relieved that I would not have to eat at Margaret's again. I did not want to see Dad and Margaret smiling at each other.
I wanted everything to be like it was. I wanted to be back in Bybanks, Kentucky, in the hills and the trees, near the cows and chickens and pigs. I wanted to run down the hill from the barn, through the kitchen door that banged behind me, and see my mother and my father sitting at the table peeling apples. Phoebe and I walked home from school together. We stopped briefly at my house so that I could call my father at work. Margaret had helped him find a job selling farm machinery. He said it made him happy as a clam at high water to know I had a new friend. Maybe this is really why he was happy, I thought, or maybe it was because he could be alone with Margaret Cadaver. Phoebe and I then walked to her house. As we were passing Margaret Cadaver's house, a voice called out, "Sal! Sal, is that you?" In the shadows on the porch, Margaret's mother, Mrs. Partridge, sat in a wicker rocker. A thick, gnarled cane with a handle carved in the shape of a cobra's head lay across her knees. Her purple dress had slipped up over her bony knees, which were spread apart, and I hate to say it, but you could see right up her skirt. Around her neck was a yellow feather scarf. "My boa," she once told me. "My most favoritist boa." As I started up the walk, Phoebe pulled on my arm. "Don't go up there," she said. "It's only Mrs. Partridge," I said. "Come on." "Who's that with you?" Mrs. Partridge said. "What's that on her face?" I knew what she was going to do. She did this with me the first time I met her. Phoebe placed her hands on her own round face and felt about. "Come here," Mrs. Partridge said. She wriggled her crooked little fingers at Phoebe. Mrs. Partridge put her fingers up to Phoebe's face and mashed around gently over her eyelids and down her cheeks. "Just as I thought. It's two eyes and a nose and a mouth." Mrs. Partridge laughed a wicked laugh that sounded as if it were bouncing off jagged rocks. "You're 13 years old. "Yes," said Phoebe. "I knew it," Mrs. Partridge said. "I just knew it." She patted her yellow feather boa. "This is Phoebe Winterbottom," I said. "She lives right next door to you." When we left, Phoebe whispered, "I wish you hadn't done that. I wish you hadn't told her I live next door." "Why not?" "You don't seem to know Mrs. Cadaver and Mrs. Partridge very well. They haven't lived there very long, only a month or so." "Don't you think it's remarkable that she guessed your age?" "I don't see what is so remarkable about it." Before I could explain, Phoebe started telling me about the time that she and her mother, father, and sister Prudence had gone to the state fair. At one booth, a crowd was gathering around a tall, thin man. "So, what was he doing?" I asked. "That's what I'm telling you," Phoebe said. Phoebe had a way of sounding like a grown-up sometimes. When she said, "That's what I'm telling you," she sounded like a grown-up talking to a child. What he was doing was guessing people's ages. All around, people were saying, "Oh," and "Amazing," and "How does he do that?" He had to guess your correct age within a year, or else you won a teddy bear. "How did he do it?" I asked. "That's what I'm telling you," Phoebe said. The thin man would look over someone carefully, close his eyes, and then he would point his finger at someone and shout, 72! At everyone? He guessed everyone to be 72? "Sal," she said, "that's what I'm trying to tell you. I was just giving an example. He might have said 10 or 30 or 72. It just depended on the person. He was astounding." I really thought it was more astounding that Mrs. Partridge could do this, but I didn't say anything. Phoebe's father wanted the thin man to guess his age. My father thinks he looks very young, and he was certain he could fool the man. After studying my father, the thin man closed his eyes, pointed his finger at my father, and shouted, 52! My father gave a little yelp, and all around people were automatically saying, "Oh," and "Amazing," and all that, but my father stopped them. "Why?" Phoebe pulled on one of her yellow curls. I think she wished she hadn't started this story in the first place. "Because he wasn't anywhere near 52, he was only 38. "Oh." And all day long, my father followed us through the fair, carrying his prize, a large green teddy bear. He was miserable. He kept saying, 52? 52? Do I look 52?
Does he? I said.
Phoebe pulled harder on her hair.
No, he does not look 52. He looks 38.
She was very defensive about her father. Phoebe's mother was in the kitchen.
I'm making blackberry pie, Mrs. Winterbottom said. I hope you like blackberries. Is there something wrong? Really, if you don't like blackberries, I could...
No, I said. I like blackberries very much. I just have some allergies, I think.
To blackberries? Mrs. Winterbottom said.
No, not to blackberries.
The truth is, I do not have allergies, but I could not admit that blackberries reminded me of my mother. Mrs. Winterbottom made me and Phoebe sit down at the kitchen table and tell her about our day. Phoebe told her about Mrs. Partridge guessing her age.
She's really remarkable, I said.
Phoebe said, It's not that remarkable, Sal. I wouldn't exactly use the word remarkable.
But Phoebe, I said, Mrs. Partridge is blind.
Both Phoebe and her mother said,
Blind?
Later, Phoebe said to me, Don't you think it's odd that Mrs. Partridge, who is blind, could see something about me, but I, who can see, was blind about her? And speaking of odd, there's something very odd about that Mrs. Cadaver.
Margaret? I said.
She scares me half to death, Phoebe said.
Why?
That's what I'm telling you, she said.
First, there is that name, Cadaver. You know what cadaver means?
Actually, I did not. It means dead body.
Are you sure? I said.
Of course I'm sure, Sal. You can check the dictionary if you want.
Do you know what she does for a living? What her job is?
Yes, I was pleased to say. I was pleased to know something.
She's a nurse.
Exactly, Phoebe said.
Would you want a nurse whose name meant dead body?
And that hair. Don't you think all that sticking out red hair is spooky? And that voice. It reminds me of dead leaves all blowing around on the ground. This was Phoebe's power. In her world, no one was ordinary. People were either perfect, like her father, or more often, they were lunatics or axe murderers. She could convince me of just about anything, especially about Margaret Cadaver. From that day on, Margaret Cadaver's hair did look spooky, and her voice did sound exactly like dead leaves. Somehow, it was easier to deal with Margaret if there were reasons not to like her, and I definitely did not want to like her.
Do you want to know an absolute secret? Phoebe said.
I did.
Promise not to tell.
I promised.
Maybe I shouldn't, she said. Your father goes over there all the time. He likes her, doesn't he?
She twirled her finger through her curly hair and let those big blue eyes roam over the ceiling.
Her name is Mrs. Cadaver, right?
Have you ever wondered what happened to Mr. Cadaver?
I never really thought about...
Well, I think I know, Phoebe said, and it is awful, purely awful.
Chapter 5. A Damsel in Distress.
At this point in my story about Phoebe, Graham said, I knew someone like Phoebe once.
Phoebe, I said.
Yes, that's right. I knew someone just like Phoebe, only her name was Gloria. Gloria lived in the wildest, most pepped-up world. A scary one, but oh, scads more exciting than my own.
Gramps said, Gloria, is she the one who told you not to marry me? Is she the one who said I would be your ruination?
Shush, Gramps said. Gloria was right about that, at least.
She elbowed Gramps.
Besides, Gloria only said that because she wanted you for herself.
Gall dang, Gramps said, pulling into a rest stop along the Ohio Turnpike. I'm tired.
I did not want to stop. Rush, 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 whispered the wind, the sky, the clouds, the trees. Rush, rush, rush.
If all he wanted to do was take a rest, that seemed a safe enough and quick enough thing for him to do. My grandparents can get into trouble as easily as a fly can land on a watermelon. 2 years ago, when they drove to Washington, D.C., they were arrested for stealing the back tires off a senator's car.
"We had two flat, sprunkle tires," my grandfather explained. "We were only borrowing the senator's tires. We were going to return them."
In Bybanks, Kentucky, you could do this. You could borrow someone's back tires and return them later. But you could not do this in Washington, D.C., and you could especially not do this to a senator's car. Last year, when Graham and Gramps drove to Philadelphia, they were stopped by the police for irresponsible driving.
"You were driving on the shoulder," a policeman told Gramps. Gramps said, "Shoulder? I thought it was an extra lane. That's a mighty fine shoulder."
So here we were, just a few hours into our trip out to Lewiston, Idaho, and we were safely stopped in a rest area. Then, Gramps noticed a woman leaning over the fender of her car. The woman was peering at her engine and dabbing a white handkerchief at various greasy items inside.
"Excuse me," Gramps said gallantly. "I believe I see a damsel in some distress."
And off he marched to her rescue. Graham sat there patting her knees and singing, "Oh, meet me in the tulips when the tulips do bloom." The woman's white handkerchief, now spotted with black grease, dangled from her fingertips as she smiled down on the back of Gramps, who had taken her place leaning over the engine.
"Might be the car busterator," he said, "or maybe not."
He tapped a few hoses.
"Might be these dang snakes," he said.
"Oh, my," the woman said. "Snakes? In my engine?" Gramps waggled a hose.
"This here's what I call a snake," he said.
"Oh, I see," the woman said. "And you think those snakes might be the problem?"
"Maybe so."
Gramps pulled on one and it came loose.
"See there?" he said. "It's off."
"Well, yes, but you..."
"Dang snakes,"
Gramps said, pulling at another one. It came loose.
"Look here, another one."
2 hours later, there was not a single snake still attached to anything to which it was supposed to be attached. The car busterator lay dismantled on the ground. Various other pieces of the woman's engine were scattered here and there. The woman called a mechanic, and once Gramps was satisfied that the mechanic was an honest man who might actually be able to repair her car, we started on our trip again.
"Salamanca," Graham said. "Tell us more about Phoebe."
"Phoebe," I said. "Phoebe Winterbottom."
"Yes, that's right,"
Graham said.
"Phoebe."
Chapter 6. Blackberries.
"What was that diabolic thing that happened to Mr. Cadaver?" Gramps asked. "You didn't tell us that yet."
I explained that just as Phoebe was going to divulge the purely awful thing that had happened to Mr. Cadaver, her father came home from work and we all sat down to dinner. Me, Phoebe, Mr. and Mrs. Winterbottom, and Phoebe's sister, Prudence. Phoebe's parents reminded me a lot of my other grandparents, the Pickfords. Like the Pickfords, Mr. and Mrs. Winterbottom spoke quietly, in short sentences, and sat straight up as they ate their food. They were extremely polite to each other, saying, "Yes, Norma," and, "Yes, George," and, "Would you please pass the potatoes, Phoebe?" and, "Wouldn't your guest like another helping?" They were picky about their food. Everything they ate was what my father would call side dishes. Potatoes, zucchini, bean salad, and a mystery casserole that I could not identify. They didn't eat meat, and they didn't use butter. They were very much concerned with cholesterol. From what I could gather, Mr. Winterbottom worked in an office creating road maps. Mrs. Winterbottom baked and cleaned and did laundry and grocery shopping. I had a funny feeling that Mrs. Winterbottom did not actually like all this baking and cleaning and laundry and shopping. And I'm not quite sure why I had that feeling, because if you just listen to the words she said, it sounded as if she was Mrs. Supreme Housewife. For example, At one point, Mrs. Winterbottom said, I believe I've made more pies in the last week than I can count. She said this in a cheery voice, but afterward, in the small silence, when no one commented on her pies, she gave a soft sigh and looked down at her plate. I thought it was odd that she baked all those pies when she seemed so concerned about cholesterol. A little later, she said, I couldn't find exactly the brand of muesli you like so much, George, but I bought something similar. Mr. Winterbottom kept eating, and again, in that silence, Mrs. Winterbottom sighed and examined her plate. I was happy for her when she announced that since Phoebe and Prudence were back in school, she thought she would return to work. Apparently, during the school terms, she worked part-time at Rocky's Rubber as a receptionist. When no one commented on her going back to work, she sighed again and poked her potatoes. A few times, Mrs. Winterbottom called her husband Sweetie Pie and Honey Bun. She said, Would you like more zucchini, Sweetie Pie? And, Did I make enough potatoes, Honey Bun? For some reason, that surprised me, those little names she used. She was dressed in a plain brown skirt and white blouse. On her feet were sensible, wide, flat shoes. She did not wear makeup. Even though she had a pleasant, round face and long, curly, yellow hair, the main impression I got was that she was used to being plain and ordinary, that she was not supposed to do anything too shocking. And Mr. Winterbottom was playing the role of father with a capital F. He sat at the head of the table with his white shirt cuffs rolled back neatly. He still wore his red and blue striped tie. His expression was serious, and his voice was deep, and his words were clear.
Yes, Norma, he said deeply and clearly.
No, Norma. He looked more like 52 than 38, but this was not something I would ever call to his or Phoebe's attention. Phoebe's sister, Prudence, was 17 years old, but she acted like her mother. She ate primly, she nodded politely, she smiled after everything she said. It all seemed peculiar. They acted so thumpingly tidy and respectable. After dinner, Phoebe walked me home. She said, You wouldn't think it to look at her. But Mrs. Cadaver is as strong as an ox. Phoebe looked behind her, as if she expected someone to be following us. I have seen her chop down trees and lug the remains clear across her backyard. Do you know what I think? I think maybe she killed Mr. Cadaver and chopped him up and buried him in the backyard. Phoebe, I said. Well, I'm just telling you what I think, that's all. That night, as I lay in bed, I thought about Mrs. Cadaver, and I wanted to believe that she was capable of killing her husband and chopping him into pieces and burying him in the backyard. And then I started thinking about the blackberries. And I remembered a time my mother and I walked around the rims of the fields and pastures in Bybanks picking blackberries. We did not pick from the bottom of the vine or from the top. The ones at the bottom were for the rabbits, my mother said, and the ones at the top were for the birds. The ones at people height were for people. Lying in bed, remembering those blackberries, made me think of something else, too. It was something that happened a couple years ago, on a morning when my mother slept late. It was that time she was pregnant. My father had already eaten breakfast, and he was out in the fields. On the table, my father had left a single flower in each of two juice glasses, a black-eyed Susan in front of my place, and a white petunia in front of my mother's. When my mother came into the kitchen that day, she said, Glory! She bent her face toward each flower. Let's go find him. We climbed the hill to the barn, crawled beneath the fence wires and crossed the field. My father was standing at the far end of the field, his back to us, hands on his hips, looking at a section of fence. My mother slowed down when she saw him. I was right behind her. It looked as if she wanted to creep up and surprise him, so I was quiet too and cautious in my steps. I could hardly keep from giggling. It seemed so daring to be sneaking up on my father, and I was sure my mother was going to throw her arms around him and kiss him and hug him and tell him how much she loved the flower on the kitchen table. My mother always loved anything that normally grows or lives out of doors, anything. Lizards, trees, cows, caterpillars, birds, flowers, crickets, toads, ants, pigs. Just before we reached my father, he turned around. This startled my mother and threw her off guard. She stopped.
"Sugar," he said.
My mother opened her mouth, and I was thinking, "Come on, throw your arms around him. Tell him." But before she could speak, my father pointed to the fence and said,
"Look at that, a morning's work."
He indicated a new length of wire strung between two new posts. There was sweat on his face and arms. And then I saw that my mother was crying. My father saw it, too.
"What?"
he said. "Oh, you're too good, John," she said. "You're too good. All you Hiddles are too good. I'll never be so good. I'll never be able to think of all the things." My father looked down at me. "The flowers," I said.
"Oh."
He put his sweaty arms around her, but she was still crying, and it wasn't what I had imagined it would be. It was all sad instead of happy. The next morning, when I went into the kitchen, my father was standing beside the table looking at two small dishes of blackberries, still shiny and wet with dew, one dish at his place and one at mine.
"Thanks," I said. "No, it wasn't me," he said. "It was your mother."
Just then, she came in from the back porch. My father put his arms around her, and they smooched, and it was all tremendously romantic. And I started to turn away, but my mother caught my arm. She pulled me to her and said to me, though it was meant for my father, I think, "See, I'm almost as good as your father." She said it in a shy way, laughing a little. I felt betrayed, but I didn't know why. It is surprising, all the things you remember just by eating a blackberry pie. Chapter 7 Illinois.
"Well, looky here," Gramps shouted. "The Illinois state line."
He pronounced Illinois, Illinois, exactly the same way everyone in Bybanks, Kentucky pronounced it. And hearing that Illinois suddenly made me homesick for Bybanks.
"What happened to Indiana?" Graham said. "Why, you gooseberry," Gramps said. "That's where we've been this past 3 hours, barreling through Indiana. You've been listening to the story of Peeby and Plum Missed Indiana. Don't you remember Elkhart? We ate lunch at Elkhart. Don't you remember South Bend? You took a pee in South Bend. Why, you missed the entire Hoosier State, you gooseberry."
He thought this was very funny.
Just then, the road curved. It actually curved. This was a shock. And off to the right was a huge, jing-bang mass of water. It was as blue as the bluebells that grow behind the barn in Bybanks, and that water just went on and on. It was all you could see. It looked like a huge blue pasture of water.
"Are we at the ocean?" Graham asked. "We're not supposed to be passing the ocean, are we?" "You gooseberry, that's Lake Michigan."
Gramps kissed his finger and put it against Graham's cheek.
"I sure would like to put my feet in that water," Graham said.
Gramps swerved across two lanes of traffic and onto the exit ramp, and faster than you could milk a cow, we were standing barefoot in the cool water of Lake Michigan. The waves splashed up on our clothes, and the seagulls flew in circles overhead, calling in one great chorus as if they were glad to see us. "Huzzah, huzzah," Graham said, wriggling her heels into the sand. "Huzzah, huzzah." We stopped that night on the outskirts of Chicago. I looked around at what I could see of Illinois from the Howard Johnson Motel, and it might as well have been 7,000 miles from the lake. It all looked precisely like northern Ohio to me, with its flat land and long, straight roads. And I thought what a very long journey this was going to be. With the dark came the whispers, "Rush, hurry, rush." That night I lay there trying to imagine Lewiston, Idaho, but my mind would not go forward to a place I had never been. Instead, I kept drifting back to Bybanks. When my mother left for Lewiston, Idaho that April, my first thoughts were, how could she do that? How could she leave me? As the days went on, many things were harder and sadder, but some things were strangely easier. When my mother had been there, I was like a mirror. If she was happy, I was happy. If she was sad, I was sad. For the first few days after she left, I felt numb, non-feeling. I didn't know how to feel. I would find myself looking around for her to see what I might want to feel. One day, about 2 weeks after she had left, I was standing against the fence watching a newborn calf wobble on its thin legs. It tripped and wobbled and swung its big head in my direction, gave me a sweet, loving look. Oh, I thought, I am happy at this moment in time. I was surprised that I knew this all by myself, without my mother there. And that night in bed, I did not cry. I said to myself, Salamanca Tree Hiddle, you can be happy without her. It seemed a mean thought, and I was sorry for it, but it felt true. In the motel, as I was remembering these things, Graham came and sat on the edge of my bed. She said, Do you miss your daddy? Do you want to call him? I did miss him, and I did want to call him, but I said, No, I'm fine, really. He might think I was a goose if I had to call him already. Okay, then, chickabiddy, Graham said. And when she leaned over to kiss me, I could smell the baby powder she always used. That smell made me feel sad, but I didn't know why. The next morning, when we got lost leaving Chicago, I prayed. Please don't let us get in an accident. Please just get us there in time. Graham said, At least it's a mighty fine day for a drive. When we finally found a road heading west, we took it. Our plan was to curve across the lower part of Wisconsin, veer into Minnesota, and then barrel straight on through Minnesota, South Dakota, and Wyoming, sweep up into Montana, and cross the Rocky Mountains into Idaho. Gramps figured it would take us about a day in each state. He didn't intend to stop too much until we reached South Dakota, and he was really looking forward to South Dakota.
We're going to see the Badlands, he said. We're going to see the Black Hills.
I didn't like the sound of either of those places, but I knew why we were going there. My mother had been there. The bus that she took out to Lewiston stopped in all the tourist spots. We were following along in her footsteps. Chapter 8, The Lunatic. Once we were well on the road out of Illinois, Graham said, Go on with Peeby. What happened next?
Do you want to hear about the lunatic?
Goodness, Graham said. As long as it's not too bloody. That Peeby is just like Gloria, I swear. A lunatic, imagine.
Graham said,
Did Gloria really have a hankering for me?
Maybe she did and maybe she didn't, Graham said.
Well, gol dang, I was only asking.
Seems to me, Graham said, you got enough to worry about concentrating on these roads without worrying about Gloria.
Gramps winked at me in the rear-view mirror.
I think our gooseberry is jealous, he said.
I am not, Graham said. Tell us about Peeby Chickabiddy.
I didn't want Graham and Gramps to get in a fight over Gloria, so I was happy to continue telling Phoebe's story.
I was at Phoebe's one Saturday morning when Mary Lou Finney called and invited us over to her house. Phoebe's parents were out, and Phoebe went all around the house checking to make sure that the doors and windows were locked. Her mother had already done this, but she made Phoebe promise to do it as well.
"Just in case," Mrs. Winterbottom had said.
I was not sure just in case of what. Maybe in case someone had snuck in and opened all the windows and doors in the 15 minutes between the time she left and the time we did.
You can never be too careful, Mrs. Winterbottom had said.
The doorbell rang. Phoebe and I looked out the window. Standing on the porch was a young man who looked about 17 or 18, although I am not as good at guessing people's ages as blind Mrs. Partridge is. The young man was wearing a black T-shirt and blue jeans, and his hands were stuffed into his pockets. He seemed nervous.
My mother hates it when strangers come to the door, Phoebe said. She is convinced that any day one of them will burst into the house with a gun and turn out to be an escaped lunatic.
Oh, honestly, Phoebe, I said. Do you want me to answer the door? Phoebe took a deep breath. We'll do it together. She opened the door and said hello in a cool voice.
Is this 49 Gray Street? The young man said.
Yes, Phoebe said.
So, the Winterbottoms live here?
After Phoebe admitted that, yes, it was the Winterbottom residence, she said, Excuse me a moment, please, and she closed the door.
Sal, do you detect any signs of lunacy?
There doesn't appear to be any place he could be hiding a gun. His jeans are really tight. Maybe he has a knife tucked into his socks.
Phoebe could be really dramatic.
He isn't wearing any socks, I said.
Phoebe opened the door again.
The young man said,
I want to see Mrs. Winterbottom. Is she here or what?
Yes, Phoebe lied. The young man looked up and down the street. His hair was curly and mussed, and there were bright pink circles on his cheeks. He wouldn't look us straight in the eye, but instead kept glancing to left and right.
I want to talk to her, he said.
She can't come to the door right now, Phoebe said. I thought he might actually cry when Phoebe said that. He chewed on his lip and blinked 3 or 4 times quickly.
I'll wait, he said.
Just a minute, Phoebe said, closing the door. She pretended to look for her mother. Mom! She called, Yoo-hoo! She went upstairs, thumping loudly on the steps. Mother! Phoebe and I returned to the door. He was still standing there with his hands in his pockets, staring mournfully at Phoebe's house. That's strange, Phoebe said to him. I thought she was here, but she must have gone out. There's a whole lot of other people here, though, she added quickly. Scads and scads of people, but no Mrs. Winterbottom.
Is Mrs. Winterbottom your mother? He asked.
Yes, Phoebe said. Would you like me to leave a message? The little pink circles on his cheeks became even pinker.
No, he said. No, I don't think so, no.
He looked up and down the street, and then up at the number above the door.
What's your name?
Phoebe. He repeated her name.
Phoebe Winterbottom.
I thought he was going to make a joke about her name, but he didn't. He glanced at me.
Are you a Winterbottom, too?
He asked. No, I said. I'm a visitor. And then he left. He just turned around, walked slowly down the porch steps and on down the street. We waited until he had turned the corner before we left. We ran all the way to Mary Lou's. Phoebe was certain that the young man was going to ambush us. Honestly, like I said, she has a vivid imagination. Chapter 9. The Message. On the way to Mary Lou's, Phoebe said, Mary Lou's family is not nearly as civilized as ours. In what way? I asked. Oh, you'll see, Phoebe said. Mary Lou Finney and Ben Finney were both in our class at school. At first I thought they were brother and sister, but Phoebe told me they were cousins, and that Ben was living with Mary Lou's family temporarily. Apparently there was always at least one stray relative living at the Finneys temporarily. It was complete pandemonium at the Finneys. Mary Lou had an older sister and three brothers. In addition, there were her parents and Ben. There were footballs and basketballs lying all over the place, and boys sliding down the banister and leaping over tables and talking with their mouths full and interrupting everyone with endless questions. Phoebe took one look around and whispered to me, "Mary Lou's parents do not seem to have much control over things." Phoebe could sound a bit prissy sometimes. Mr. Finney was lying in the bathtub with all his clothes on, reading a book. From Mary Lou's bedroom window, I saw Mrs. Finney lying on top of the garage with a pillow under her head. "What's she doing?" I asked. Mary Lou peered out of the window. "King of kings, she's taking a nap." When Mr. Finney got out of the bathtub, he went out in the backyard and tossed a football around with Dennis and Dougie, two of Mary Lou's brothers. Mr. Finney shouted, "Over here!" and "That-a-way!" and "Way to go!" The previous weekend, we had had a school sports day. Parents were watching their children show off, and there were even some events for the parents, too, such as the three-legged race and pass the grapefruit. My father could not come, but Mary Lou's parents were there, and so were Phoebe's. Phoebe had said, "The games are a little childish sometimes, which is why my parents don't usually participate." Her parents stood on the sidelines while Mr. and Mrs. Finney ran around shouting, "Over here!" and "Way to go!" In the three-legged race, the Finneys kept falling over. Phoebe said, "I wonder if Mary Lou is embarrassed because of the way her parents are acting." I didn't think it was embarrassing. I thought it was nice, but I didn't say so to Phoebe. I think that deep down, Phoebe thought it was nice, too, and she wished her own parents would act more like the Finneys. She couldn't admit this, though, and in a way, I liked this about Phoebe, that she tried to defend her family. On the day that Phoebe and I met the potential lunatic and then went over to Mary Lou's, a couple of other peculiar things happened. We were sitting on the floor of Mary Lou's room, and Phoebe was telling Mary Lou about the mysterious potential lunatic. Mary Lou's brothers, Dennis, Doug, and Tommy, kept dashing in and out of the room, leaping on the bed and squirting us with squirt guns. Mary Lou's cousin Ben was lying on her bed, staring at me with his black, black eyes. They looked like two sparkly black discs set into big, round sockets. His dark eyelashes were long and feathery, casting shadows on his cheeks.
"I like your hair," he said to me. "Can you sit on it?"
"Yes, if I want." Ben picked up a piece of paper from Mary Lou's desk, lay back down on the bed, and drew a picture of a lizard-like creature with long black hair that, as it ran down the lizard's back and under its bottom, became a chair with legs. Underneath this, Ben had written, "Salamander sitting on her hair." "Very amusing," Phoebe said. She left the room, and Mary Lou followed her. I turned around to hand the drawing back to Ben, just as he leaned forward and mashed his lips into my collarbone. His lips rested there a moment. My nose was pressed into his hair, which smelled like grapefruit. Then he rolled off the bed, grabbed the drawing, and dashed out of the room. Did he actually kiss my collarbone? And if he did, why did he do that? Was the kiss supposed to land somewhere else, like on my mouth, for example? That was a chilling thought. Had I imagined it? Maybe he merely brushed against me as he was rolling off the bed. On the way home from Mary Lou's that day, Phoebe said, "Wasn't it, well, loud there?" "I didn't mind," I said. "I was thinking of something my father once said to my mother. We'll fill the house up with children. We'll fill it right up to the brim." But they hadn't filled it up. It was just me and them, and then it was just me and my father. When we got back to Phoebe's house, her mother was lying on the couch, dabbing at her eyes with a tissue. "Is something wrong?" Phoebe asked.
"Oh, no," Mrs. Winterbottom said. "Nothing's wrong."
Then Phoebe told her mother about the potential lunatic who had come to the house earlier. This news upset Mrs. Winterbottom. She wanted to know exactly what he had said and what Phoebe said and what he looked like and how he acted and how Phoebe acted, on and on. At last, Mrs. Winterbottom said, "I think we had better not mention this to your father." She reached forward as if to hug Phoebe, but Phoebe pulled away. Later, Phoebe said, "That's odd. Usually my mother tells my father absolutely everything."